Hello, and welcome to Revolutionize Your Love Life. Do you want to know more about love relationships, what makes them work, how to create the one of your best dreams? Do you want to be in a really healthy, juicy love relationship? In these podcasts, we will give ideas and practical advice to light your way. Whether you're looking for a love partner, already in a relationship you wish could be better, or leaving one that has run its course, there will be something to inspire, empower, and support you. Revolutionize Your Love Life is a fortnightly podcast where you will access the knowledge and wisdom of love experts and relationship coaches from across the world to help you find true fulfillment in love. I am your host, Heather Garbutt. Welcome.
Hello, lovely people in search of love. I've got a real treat for you today. I'm here with Kat Peckett. She is a doctor in clinical psychology, a trauma specialist, and she works with people to support them in pregnancy, preparation for birth, and in the early years of parenthood. She loves working from a biopsychosocial spiritual approach, particularly what makes our hearts sing. She brings us joy. She does indeed. What brings us joy? What gets in the way of love? What gets in the way of connecting with others? Where we get our energy from and what drains us? Sometimes we need to ask the really big questions, she says. Why am I here? And where am I heading? My Freudian slip was right there. She does bring me joy. It's been an absolute pleasure connecting with her. And it's a particular joy to me to find somebody who is so centered in love, who has the body of knowledge and the status of doctor that she brings to this work and she brings to this world. She's a gift to humanity. Hello, Kat. It's really lovely to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a very lovely introduction. Thank you so much for welcoming me into your space and, you know, your work around love as well.
You're so welcome. So let's begin with a bit of context. Why is we coming together to understand trauma in the context of relationships?
You see, I think the conversation between us has been so interesting because both of us are thinking about relationships and love. And I love what you're offering out there in the world for helping people to really kind of turn inwards and think about what it is that they're looking for in love in general. And I guess the bit that I offer out there to people in our world around love and relationship is to think about how trauma might get in the way of us loving each other, being able to connect with others. And often I think about that in the context of people's early life experiences. So who was looking after them and how did they receive the care from others? I think attachment is a really big one in the world of, you know, relational trauma and emotional safety.
This is where it really fits in with calling in the one, because unconscious uncoupling, because attachment styles are in these deep roots and they also affect how we're going to relate to ourselves and other people. And that's the core of the work in both of those programs. Please say more.
Yeah, well, I really love that about your program and what you're offering there, because I'm taking from your work is that people are also invited in to look at the patterns and what's been played out between people. So some of my colleagues in the attachment world and attachment parenting, they invite us in to think about really what's happening, let's say, between you and me, the space in between, that dance. And I think that from very early on, we're being given messages whether it's safe to have emotional needs or not. And I don't think that's necessarily intentional by our early caregivers to give us the message that they shouldn't be cared for. I would take it from that we're in a really big evolutionary process, and that previous generations would have parented the best that they knew and they could. And now we're in a place where people are thinking about maybe other layers to it. And so in the world of like attachment, parenting and caregiving, what happens is that you think, look at, you know, the baby calls out in distress, and how is the caregiver then going to respond to that distress? Are they going to attune to it? Are they going to validate? Are they going to help the baby or the toddler organize their feelings and be with them and tend to them? So beside the physical needs, what is happening with the emotional needs? And babies need their attunement to feel safe and to thrive. And what may happen from very early on is that babies then experience that it's not okay to have emotional needs. So caregivers are too busy or preoccupied, or like also misattuned and abusive, might then send out signals that it's not okay. So then fast forward time, these babies would have found ways to protect themselves and to survive. Fast forward, then later on, people will then kind of go into a bit more of an autopilot with their ways of relating to others in this protective mode, and then find themselves others that they keep reenacting this with. So someone who might be somewhat dismissive or cold or rejecting or mean and really unwelcoming as well. So I don't think that we always recognize that we're in these kind of relational patterns, and it needs almost like a different network or a different support person or other environments where then the adult then starts to realize, hang on a minute, something is not okay here. Why do I end up having relationships with people who make me feel really bad about myself, or where I actually feel like I have to keep having really big emotional protectors up, and I can't really show how I feel, and then staying in hiding or being isolated or not being really seen. I think a lot of my work is to uncover with people, what is it that's being played out? Where does it come from? How does it make them feel? And how would they prefer it to feel? What would that look like? You need to be able to understand what you're doing first before you can start making any changes, I think, you know? But that's actually a complicated work.
It is. I just love what you're saying, because I know your approach is very different and probably goes a lot deeper in the sort of curative factors, but it really fits, like we were talking about before we got on the call, about the patterns in relationship is the way that my work comes in. What are these patterns? How do they act out? And for me, it's actually being with another person. My clients can be with me, and from that position, I can offer other perspectives that they haven't considered before, and they can begin to really see for themselves. They run with that ball, and it really opens things out. And I'm sure they do with you too. You suddenly realize what they've been missing, and they can imagine, you know, we do the visioning and the intention setting, which I think really sets people on the road for what they're looking for in a very powerful way, and gives them the energy. Something is pulling them. They want that loving, trusting, true love, committed, romantic relationship. They want that, even though they've never experienced it. They can imagine it. And then that shifts things. Please, please say.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that I love that part of your work, because there's a lot of science that backs that up as well, that shows us that we need to be able to just even envisage something to be able to move towards it. We need to have a sense of what it could feel like to be able to do more of that, I guess. So you know, it's lovely, some of the research that shows you that even if you're imagining doing a particular type of exercise, your body is already responding and it's measurable. If you then do the exercise and the visualization together, you're going to have even more success in what you're trying to achieve. So we know from the world of, let's say, sports psychology and or the performance coaching is very much in line with this idea that you need to be able to really visualize in your mind what it could be and what you want, like even stronger than that. So you have all your senses in it. And I have done some of your imagination work online with your podcast, and it's lovely. You know, like, yeah, I'm imagining what I want to have here, and that feels really good. Why wouldn't I want to call in the best for me? But when your experiences have been so traumatic, it feels, I work with people where it feels unimaginable. I mean, this is for other people. This, what you're talking about, is not for me. Those kind of themes. So people who feel like their self-worth is so low that they're the meaning for, that might not always be on the forefront of their minds. They might not always have so much awareness in this, but what they're acting out is, I'm at service to you. I don't matter. Or you are only going to do me bad, or like you're going to do me harm because that's what I deserve. It's very painful when that internal part is missing that says it's okay to want more.
This is so powerful. It's painful to hear.
And
it rings true.
So, you know, that's why this is such intimate and delicate work as well, where we as practitioners, whether you or me or any of our colleagues who might be listening to this, have to be really conscious of the space that we're providing for someone else is emotionally safe. We need to be the safe container too, so we can receive sometimes information that they've never shared with somebody else because it's been so tucked away. It feels so shameful to be this person, to feel these things, to have experienced certain things, even when these are experiences that were abusive towards them. What it's about is, I must be bad, otherwise that wouldn't have happened to me. I must deserve this kind of treatment.
Absolutely. You know, this, you're naming a lot of what we call the false beliefs. I call them adaptation beliefs. Mm-hmm. St. Catherine calls them false love identities. I am bad. I'm not safe. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. I'm not valuable. I don't matter. I don't belong. There are more, there are lots more, but it's really fitting with what you're saying.
Wow, and when you summarize it for me, like that, give it that right back to me, I'm noticing how that lands in my body with weight. You know, they're all the subtle ways and how that can be acted out between love bonds and between family members. So, you know, the way I think sometimes people learn to adapt is by tucking it away, pretending that it's not happening. They can be like, did that really happen? Part as well. So where it's surreal and almost in a dream state. So people can become quite fuzzy when you start talking about early life experiences, as in fuzzy in the head, fuzzy memories.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore flit in and out of like a presence in their everyday life. So as soon as things become stressful and in their here and now, they are not quite present, somewhat flitting away because something would have triggered them to not feel safe. So it's quite hard to be in a romantic relationship with a lot of closeness when you're flitting off regularly, and as it's a way of, you know, shutting down or dissociating. That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, it's in a state of fear and overwhelm.
Yes. Yes, it's definitely in the category around survival and fear. And another way on how that might show in relationship is that someone's constantly overthinking. So thinking about the other person's needs, or that, you know, is it going to go wrong? Constantly planning ahead, not being able to ease into just going with the flow, needing quite rigid organizational structures in place, never feel like they can just relax into the here and now because they're not ready, they're not prepared enough. So there's a difficulty in trusting the process, and then also understandably a difficulty in trusting in others. Or like one of the other things that I see regularly is people just being really numb, low, absent, and very early on having found a way to like think that they just don't have emotional needs. I guess in my world that's not real, that can't be a thing. We are have evolved to be deeply relational, so when someone then comes and says they don't have any emotional needs, I'm doubtful that that is a long-term plan for a relationship.
And this is where codependency comes in, and the sort of empaths in the world. From my point of view, it's like I only see it, I'm sort of, you know, as if it's me talking, I only see the needs of others, and I shape myself around their needs. And the secondary gain from that is that I might get some of my needs met.
Yeah, that's a great description of this. Yeah. Yeah, I work in a helping profession. I'm surrounded by colleagues who are helpers and wanting to do good things for others, and where we have to remind each other regularly, what are your needs? What is it that you need? You know, so this can be expressed in lots of different ways, right? This dance that you're talking about there.
Yeah. And let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, there's a place for love and taking care of others. It's just we have to do that from a full cup. We have to look after ourselves first and prioritize our feelings and needs.
Yes, I think that's the key, isn't it? The magic ingredient is like how do we feel in our everyday life in relation to others? I love being at service to my community. I think I'm so grateful to what this brings me in my life. But it's not a martyr kind of process. It's like I'm not there for everybody else, and then, you know, for me, somewhere comes in here as well. Actually, these are experiences that are deeply rewarding and very enjoyable, even amongst like some of the traumatic stuff, but because it's very real. You know, I guess the joyous bit is also where people really want to show up and for themselves, not for me, but showing up for themselves and really making a conscious decision to want to bring about change. And I think it's very possible. I have plentiful of evidence through my work and through my personal life that even when your early start has been less than ideal, you can move into whole new ways of relating with doing the internal work, doing the processing. You're already, you know, on a really good path if you're recognizing when it's not going well for you that something needs to change. And with that, spending some time and resources and energy into what is it that's happening, so you create awareness, and then also processing the feelings, so you can then help kind of move out of the survival mode, you know. So by the time people come and work with me, the majority of people have moved out of unsafe terrains, and that, I mean, like really emotionally and physically unsafe spaces, and often have moved more into a place where there is a lot more safety in their life, and now they're ready to do that internal work. And then by processing some of the big emotions and feelings, the whole of the person can start to come to the kind of conversation. So it's integrating the parts that have been split off or neglected or rejected. So that's very psychotherapy kind of talk, isn't it? So it was kind of splitting off parts of ourselves to bring them back in. that we can just be all of ourselves. I love the internal family systems work for that as well. So I'm not fully trained, but I think it's a very lovely new way of thinking about how we can have all of our parts together, understanding them, and then seeing that behind all of those parts is our true self, you know, and the true self is the one who is really eager to live a full and rich life, you know.
Yes, absolutely. And that for me is what shines through when all of these patterns have been addressed. I mean, it's never a done deal, but you know,
no.
you always get triggered one way or another. But it's the depth to which you get triggered and how long it lasts in the triggering. And I'm having clients saying now that, you know, it used to take 2 weeks to recover. Now it takes 2 days, or now it takes 2 hours or 20 minutes. You know, it gets shorter and shorter the more you're used to it. And the more you can say, this is happening again. Just need to go out of this room and calm down and then come back as my adult self and negotiate for me from that empowered place rather than be small and reactive. And in that sort of petty playground mode of, na-na-na-na-na, I'm going to be better. I'm going to prove that I'm right, you know, which never gets us anywhere.
No, it doesn't. And does, and yet we still find ourselves sometimes
Oh,
feeling
yes.
unforgiving and punishing or like murderous. Even, you know, as a parent, I've sometimes found like experienced really murderous feelings. I'm like, oh, I never thought I would be experiencing them. That's such a shocking experience, you know. So yeah, I love what you're describing there. That's one of the key changes, isn't it? I remember many years ago starting therapy for myself and having a fantasy over, I will be sorted at some point. When are we done? When am I sorted? And also having, you know, I remember vividly saying, but if I start crying now, I might never stop. And so that's it, isn't it? I think the shift I can, you know, talk about just even for myself, but also by seeing other people who I work with and who I support, is that we don't become so stuck in one mode. We have the moving out of trauma modes or trauma reactivity is when we can move more easily from one state to the other, and we can experience different states, and we're not just in one, not just angry, not just anxious, not just shut down. You know, I'm saying just because it feels like, you know, that feels quite minimizing, and I don't intend it like that. I'm meaning that we don't get to have the full range of emotional experiences. And so one of the therapy modalities that I really like is EMDR. So eye movement desensitization reprocessing. It's just too big a mouthful. So EMDR, where I work with the neuropsychological aspects of trauma that's held in the body and held in our nervous system. And we can do the talking part and the body and nervous system part together. And what I often say to people, and they confirm through their own descriptions of this in other ways, is we are not going to take away the trauma memory, but what we're doing is helping people process the traumatic events, that it becomes more integrated, and it means that people can look at the memories and relate to it differently. So they're not like hot experiences. As soon as they're triggered, they're all in the experience again. I have seen people process the most traumatic events and then eventually get to a place where they can look at it in their mind again, or go back in time looking at the events and just feel less about it, and they have it in their life as just like you would have like different images you would have in a film, for example. They just are. That doesn't mean you have to be okay with what happened. It just means that you're not living it right now. That then means it's very possible to be in the here and now, which is a gift, you know, not being living in the past.
Yes, not living in the trauma and repeating it. Yeah. Bless you. That's beautiful work and beautifully put. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how unprocessed trauma can manifest.
Okay. So unprocessed trauma, there are lots of different ways of explaining it from a neuropsychological world or from the therapeutic, so many lenses and languages. Here is my amalgamated version for this moment. So unprocessed trauma can look like someone is reliving an event over and over again. So they might find themselves really quickly reliving something through a sensory experience. So they might feel something in their body going hot and cold, or like digestive responses. So feeling really sick or needing to go to the loo very quickly, dry mouth, you know, the sweaty anxiety responses, heartbeats. Those are kind of the physiological sensory experience you might have by having had a trigger from the outside world through a smell or through touch or through words that someone might use in relationships. So when people have had previous traumas that are unprocessed, it means that they are projecting some of this onto their partner also. So someone who might come in with a very loving gesture, or might not be a loving gesture, it might actually really not be okay, but in the unprocessed part, but I'm taking it that someone might have a loving gesture come their way and they're experiencing it as highly threatening, something to protect from. Unprocessed trauma often resurfaces for people at night time, so nightmares is a very common experience. So the very common things are flashbacks, nightmares, sensory experiences, panic attacks, isolation. That's how I would often see this. Does that answer that one, or do you think I should explain something else?
No, I think that's great. And I was thinking about how all of those things, if you're waiting to be triggered into those things, how that comes up in relationship. And trying to predict and protect. I think you were talking earlier about overthinking, the predicting, preventing, planning for future events, being controlling, over-preparing. I mean, it can go the other way. I think you can dissociate and just sort of jump at the last minute sort of thing. Difficulty in trusting people.
Yes.
All of those things were things we mentioned before, which I think I see repeatedly when I'm working with people who are trying out relationships in a healthy way for the first time. And they find somebody who's healthy and secure in their attachment, and they're second guessing and very anxious and looking for every little micro action, or it can be an absence that somebody fell asleep rather than responding to a text and didn't respond till the next morning. And it's hugely triggering of a feeling of rejection, isolation, and falling into nothing.
Yes.
Those sorts of things. I'm just wondering if there's anything more that you would like to say around that.
Yeah, there's a lot in there already, isn't it? And what came for me as another example was in some of the parenting work with the attuning to a baby and the you know, the call and response interaction, the dance between, you know, interacting with eyes and facial expression and movements between baby and a caregiver. I have sometimes experienced how we have videos, for example, with some of the work that we do, where there's examples of attunement between a male caregiver and a baby, and that sometimes people respond quite angrily towards that. So it invokes something unsafe, you know, something along the lines of that's too intrusive, or it's overpowering or grooming or this. And it's a very gentle dance, very, very, very gentle. So what that sometimes tells me is that attunement can feel really threatening. And I think I as a therapist can experience that. So me being very attuned to someone who comes into the room who hasn't had that before can find that almost overwhelming. There's like a flood of feelings. So we have to, you know, just go slowly and really give that time and space to explore. But in the defended place where that person might be in that time, is they are doing absolutely the right thing for themselves. we can't be that close, we can't connect, you know. Oh my goodness, get away with all your kindness, please. I'll get away with all your love.
Yes. Yes, it's completely indigestible and not trustworthy, too good to be true, suspicious, you know.
And then comes the next thought of, I have to get ready for the next bad thing. So this might be nice, okay, but when is it going to have to stop? Or when is something bad going to happen? So again, back to preparing for the catastrophe around the corner. So letting our guards down is not that easy as a species.
No, no. And when I look back, you know, I was born in 1958, and the received wisdom then was put the baby in the pram and put them down the garden when they're crying.
Oh.
And feed them 4 hourly, and they're supposed to sleep in between. And playing with a baby wasn't part of the deal, you know, it's that sort of stuff. And I could see that retrospectively when I looked at the people in the neighborhood that were bringing up children younger than me. So the way they were fed, it was sort of rammed into their mouths and then scraped off the outside and rammed in again. And the poor little baby was sort of stunned and blinking, you know. It was just how things were. And yet, if we look at that in terms of relationship, it's like you've just got to swallow everything. You've just got to tolerate everything. And your needs are too much. So you have to be put away somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very powerful example you're giving us. Thank you so much for sharing. I think your story is not, you're not alone with that experience, what you're describing there. And I, relatively speaking, that's a really short time, isn't it? And it's where we have come from and where we're heading towards. And I would love to talk about what we're heading towards, because I'm seeing big change. And I'm seeing big change in how we as a collective are speaking about love and attunement and emotional health and emotional safety. So as part of my work, I do a lot of training for teams and staff to think about trauma-informed care principles. And actually what we'll get to quite quickly is, how safe do they feel at work? And how safe is it to be attuned to others at work and caring at work? And but actually, even though we're right in the middle of this messy process, what I'm seeing is that we have systems and institutions that are really keen for this to take place. So it is being put into policies. It is being spoken about. We are moving towards wanting to do this better. We just haven't quite got it all figured out. And I see similarities with parenting. People want to be really loving and caring and want to not be punishing and authoritarian in a way that's cold and overpowering, but not all of us have the tools all the time to make that work. And so we have to meet ourselves with a lot of kindness and compassion for that, because we are gonna have misattuned moments, which is right now we have to go with good enough. 30% is good, right? And we have to put perfectionism to bed. Somehow at some point, our media and our cultural collective has kind of been giving us a message of these perfect images, perfect bodies, perfect lives. And, you know, if you got the house, the car, the dog, the kids, the holiday and all these kind of things, you're going to be fine, right? Oh, it's
such a tall order.
Well, and it's nobody's reality. I haven't come across that being the happy ending.
No.
If anything, it's a burden and an expectation that none of us can meet. So what we have to figure out is all these very, very personal ways of discovering our own truths and living our own authentic lives. And that takes work, and it's super worth it. Completely the energy, because then it will keep feeding that, right? If you create more energy from doing the things that bring you a lot of joy. Is this an okay time for me to bring in Dr. Lisa Miller's work?
Please do, yeah.
I love her book. It's called The Awakened Brain. She's done decades worth of research into spirituality. It's measurable. I mean, that's the coolest bit. And basically, that's one of the key messages here. We have come from a very materialistic kind of place, I think, culturally. There's been a lot of development away from intuition and feeling within and feeling our connectedness because we've been so busy in our heads. And she's gone and done a lot of research into spirituality and flow. And it's another way of my EMDR work. How do we integrate all those kind of parts of the whole of a brain? Well, if you are someone who goes into this flow state through anything, exercise, meditation, sewing, gardening, whatever your version is of flow, you can measure that in the brain. The brain goes into a whole integrated way of communicating and it allows us to drop down. In mindfulness practices, it's drop down. You can feel it. I do a lot of mindfulness practices with people and myself. And that drop down place is where we can feel a whole new layer of information which comes from within. And the more you do it, the more you enjoy it, you know. So it's not like a perfect place, and it still takes practice, daily practice to go there. And yet the more you do it, the more you will feel drawn to do more of it, because it can be so, I don't know, fulfilling, I guess that's the word that comes with it. So she makes something a little, you know, someone who knows that experience can feel it and they will know what I'm talking about. But some people don't know what this feels like. They can go and read in her book what science tells us about it. And so we're marrying up old and new practices, you know, the old and the new. And yeah, I think that's a really good message to hold on to, that we can really influence how we feel internally through lots of flow practices.
And this is key for me, because it's like, how do we resource ourselves? Now, resourcing sounds like practical things, but emotionally resource ourselves. And to be a good enough parent, we don't need to be out there working, bringing in the money and buying all the toys. You know, we actually need to be present. And how do we resource ourselves to be present? This is what you're talking about. Being present to yourself gives something immense in terms of being present for others, particularly our children.
Yes. Yes, it's a very joyous experience. I haven't, you know, I don't always manage to be in that place, but when I am, it's really worth it. It's really beautiful. And so I think that's what makes our work also more impactful, is when we're not coming from a place of like books, head and learning, but from living, experiencing and sharing. So I can only really work best with the things that I also understand. Parenting has not always come easily to me. Relating has not always come easily to me. Loving hasn't always come easily to me. So hence I end up working in a field where I really have experienced difference, and I know that it can make a difference to others too. So just, this is what I'm offering. And, you know, I've said this before to you, this, I think culturally we're also at a place where we're moving into a whole new layer or way of loving and relating and connecting. And, you know, so maybe some of the other cultures or times have been more engaged with love and connection. So like in Sanskrit, they have 78 different words for the word love, apparently. So that's the love that we're talking about between the therapist and a client, or the love between a mother and a child, or the student for the teacher, or the love for your pizza. There's all different types of loves, but we have love. You know, or I might like, but we have very few gradients that would explain the complexity of the all these feelings that we might have. So I'm really hopeful, and I, you know, I have enough evidence to see and know we're moving into something new as a culture, which is very promising. It's very beautiful.
Yeah, I feel like we are part of a wave of love coming through the world. You just hear it in the way people talk, and the intentionality, and the determination to be closer and more cooperative. I mean, you hear all the other stuff too, but I think that's the kicks of an old regime in a way. And this is emerging, and I have faith in its strength to help us be connected as one human being to another, you know, whatever cross of divide it is, you know, whether it's men
Yes.
and women or black and white or Israeli and Palestinian, that there's some sort of affinity in humanity that I am longing to prevail.
That's a great mission to have, yes, to be part of weaving the connections between people, allowing them to be with each other in the most loving way, knowing that that will also be with all our messy parts and all our complicated parts and all our histories, but that we can also meet our ancestors with love and compassion too, who didn't know. Some of them would have known great wisdom at different times, and at other times, not. Where we kind of go, what?
Absolutely.
Those practices are no longer acceptable. We won't do that again. We're trying not to repeat things and moving towards what we do want.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a, you know, I'm longing not to say this, but I am longing to say it and name it. It feels like, you know, when I'm a well-fed, well-heated, comfortable person in my home, that we have moved on. And at the same time, I feel for the people who, in this cold winter that we've been experiencing, are choosing between food and heat. And that is wrong. And we need to have that identification with each other to make things more egalitarian so people can grow, because there are really gifted people with all sorts of things to give to the world who can't because they're busy surviving. And that's what I was thinking. Our ancestors were busy surviving. And I was going to refer to that as the past, but it isn't. It
No,
isn't.
it's
It's
not
still
the past.
current. No.
You're right. It's very, very current. You know, and through my NHS work, I see a lot of deprivation. And yeah, we have to. Yeah, there's a lot going on that we are having to figure out as a whole species. There's a lot of awareness, right? You know, I'm very aware about the discrepancies between some of the very rich and the very poor, for example, the very marginalized and the, you know, much more accepted. And, you know, there's a lot of mess. And I think, you know, but in therapeutic terms, there's a lot that's currently feeling like a breakdown, systems breaking down. And therapeutically, I think when I'm working with someone who feels like they're breaking down, I also think that they're breaking through. They're going into something very new. It's fertile ground, and yet it's the most painful place to be in. So anyone who's been in a breakdown place will know that it's raw. But the rawness is also that what allows new thinking and reviewing, because when we're going on autopilot, we just keep going, you know, it's like we just, and I think that's been part of the problem, the lethargy, the, we're okay, aren't we? You know, oh yeah, ticking along. But when we're just
complacence.
That's the word, isn't it, really? Yes. I don't think many people are feeling so complacent right now, I think.
No. And certainly, in terms of being stimulated to grow mentally and emotionally, spiritually, there's quite often a trigger that sets that in motion. And a sort of line in the sand, I've had enough of this. This is not happening anymore. I'm going to do something about it. And I think discomfort, you know, we can handle a degree of discomfort, but when it gets to pain or some sort of critical mass, then we decide to make the change. And I think that's happening for us on a global level. I mean, you know, the calling in the one and conscious uncoupling looks continually about I am, others are, life is, love is, marriages, the world is, you know, because we project whatever the feelings we have about ourselves out onto the world. We're depriving ourselves. The world will be experienced as a depriving place. So I think we are really evolving. We're on the edge of evolution. I don't pretend to have a full vision of it, but I see a chink of it. And I hope, you know, that's the crack where the light gets in, as Leonard Cohen would put it, and it would all become so much better in our lifetimes and beyond.
Wow, what a beautiful conversation. See, I knew I would enjoy coming to the podcast and having the conversation with you. It's just also letting me go away with lots of food for thought and thinking about, yeah, where are we heading? Those existential questions have to be part of it. Why am I
they
here
do.
And where am I heading?
Is that a good place for us to round off?
I think
Thank
so.
You so much. Thank you so much, Kat Peckett. Where can we find you? Give us your contact details and your website.
Okay, so I'm actually just in the process of working on a new website, which is anam-kara.uk. And the reason why I've chosen Anamkara is a deep Celtic tradition, a word that's coming from the place of, you know, having it like your soul friend. I'm not pretending to be anyone's soul friend necessarily. That's not necessarily what it's about, but it's about this deep connection. And when you're in deep connection, you can unfold, you can kind of untangle all of the knots and kind of come to a different place of discovery about yourselves and your soul, and like a place of greater meaning in this world of being here for a reason. So I didn't know, over 21 years ago, I started my journey into psychology. I did not know that spirituality would become such a big element to understanding ourselves and my journey. So anyway, so I ended up having anam-kara.uk as my website, and I'm working on that.
Okay.
A very easy way to get hold of me is catherine.peckett@gmail.com. Any
that's
inquiries?
Lovely. Okay. Oh, that's lovely. Oh, thank you so much, Kat. That's just been wonderful to be with you. And maybe we'll do it again, eh?
Yeah, I would love that. Yes, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life. I'd like to know what has been your biggest takeaway from this conversation. Do take a minute and share this with us and visit us on our Facebook page. You can connect with me personally on my email at heather@heathergarbutt.com. If you can think of someone who will benefit from listening to this podcast, please do share it with them. If you have any feedback on how I can improve it, please do reach out to me, as I'm always keen to learn more. Thank you so much again for listening, and we'll meet again on the next episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life.